fruits and vegetables for your health. Go to happyhealthy.ms for shopping tips and money-saving ideas.
Hey, Mississippi!
Happy Healthy is a campaign created to help you live a happier, healthier life from the Mississippi State University Extension Service.
Hey, Mississippi!
This institution is an equal opportunity provider.
Hey, Mississippi!
How people feel in other parts of the country where they haven't been getting a lot of rain. But I can say that I think southern Mississippi is probably a little on the high side. I don't think we're in any danger of running into a drought at any point in time. So it's just insanity. Everybody's talking about what's going on with President Trump. President Trump, of course, doing some golf and digging in, getting ready to meet with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. And we go to one of our favorite outsiders for this whole inside thing, Bernie Sanders. What is independent Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont doing in regard to this important visit from the President of the United States to the President of Russia? Bernie Sanders saying Trump should confront Vladimir Putin over the Mueller probe indictments. Now, if you haven't been paying attention to when the Mueller part of the investigation started, it began at the end of May of 2017. So it's been almost 14 months since Robert Mueller, former head of the FBI in the United States, was asked by the president and the Congress to head up this investigative panel. It's not like the president has ever disagreed with Mueller being in charge of this investigation. And what has happened in the last week, more indictments have been handed down. Mueller indicted 12 Russian operatives. So Bernie Sanders called on President Trump to confront Russian President Vladimir Putin at their summit today over new indictments handed down in special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian efforts to meddle in the 2016 presidential election. Senator Sanders called on Americans to speak with one voice toward Putin, urging the Democrats and Republicans to come together and stand against foreign efforts to interfere in the U.S. political system after special investigative counsel Robert Mueller indicted those 12 Russian operatives. The fact that these indictments named 12 members of Russia's military intelligence service strongly suggests that the interference was directed from the highest levels of the Russian government. It's imperative that Special Counsel Mueller be allowed to continue his investigation free of pressure, Senator Bernie Sanders said in a statement. We must also speak with one voice in making clear to Vladimir Putin, we will not allow you to interfere in our democratic processes or those of our allies. Now, the president himself should be the one to bring this message to Putin, added Senator Sanders. President Trump is expected to meet with his Russian counterpart at a bilateral summit in Helsinki on Monday, where the two will discuss possible areas of common ground amid months of escalated tension over accusations of election interference and Russia's possible involvement in the poisoning of several victims of a nerve agent on British soil. Now, other Democratic senators, including Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, a frequent Sanders ally, have called on President Trump to cancel the planned meeting entirely. The Department of Justice criminal charges provide hard evidence that Russian intel agents attacked America to boost their favorite candidates, undermine others, and influence our elections. Cancel your ridiculous Putin summit and get your butt back on a plane to the United States, tweeted Senator Elizabeth Warren on Friday. President Trump took a softer tone against Vladimir Putin before leaving the United States for a NATO summit in Brussels this week, expressing the hope that he could become friends with Putin in the future. He is representing Russia. I'm representing the United States, President Trump said. So, in a sense, we're competitors, not a question of friend or enemy. He's not my enemy. Hopefully, someday, maybe he'll be a friend, the president added. So there you go. Of course, the president, being a Republican, under attack from the Democratic wing of the Senate, and even though he's an independent from the state of Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders ran for the presidential nomination on the Democratic side of things, and then the Democratic primaries. What I find personally most interesting about all of that is that Senator Sanders really is kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater here, because he of all people should be wanting everything to be investigated and uncovered with this investigation, because of the way the Democratic Party treated his candidacy. It came out after the election, of course, that the Democratic Party itself was in a form of conspiracy against the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, because he was too close to upsetting Hillary Clinton and possibly keeping her from getting the Democratic nomination in the 2016 presidential election. And yet here you have Bernie Sanders, who is most likely going to be a candidate in the upcoming 16 months for the presidency of the United States, possibly again as a Democrat. He registered as a Democrat in order to go through the Democratic Party primaries in the 2016 election. It's not going to surprise me one bit if Senator Sanders goes in as a Democrat again for the 2020 election cycle. We'll have to see how that goes out. Now, my personal opinion that I've expressed here on Voice of the People more than once since this all began, and before Robert Mueller was appointed a special counsel to work with the panel of 11 individuals who are all members of the Democratic Party that are investigating this thing, which we now call the Russia probe, in relation to whether or not the Russian hackers had anything to do with President's campaign or Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's campaign. And the 12 indictments that were handed down against Russian intelligence agents who hacked the Democratic National Committee. They hacked the Democrat servers. They hacked Hillary Clinton's campaign. So far, there has not been a shred of physical evidence tying any Russian intelligence operatives to the Trump campaign, or in as much as we have been told, anyone remotely connected to the president's campaign, who the president would have kept on staff throughout the entire candidacy and then worked in the Trump White House. The Trump White House has had probably one of the highest rates of turnover for a president in modern memory. It's not very surprising. And it's not as if the president is picking people up and debasing their work with the White House or anything based on anything to do with this Russia investigation. Anytime the president has let go an official at the White House, had any member of the cabinet resign, or told a member of the cabinet that the situation wasn't working out the way the president favored running his administration, the media has taken it upon themselves to say that the reason that the person in question was being let go by the Trump administration is because of information they may or may not have regarding this Russia investigation. And, you know, that's an unfair assessment. That is not necessarily the case. Yeah, it would be one thing if they had anybody who was criminally indicted that had something to do with it. And so far, it's just come out empty. You know, everybody acts like they're waiting for the other shoe to drop, or that we should be treating a situation as if, you know, we're the guy that's been given his last cigarette before he goes up before the firing squad, and we're all waiting to see what happens. And a lot of people are taking a conjecture that Robert Mueller would be the guy facing the firing squad with the cigarette in his mouth, waiting for the president to tell them to go out and end the investigation by firing Robert Mueller. If the president didn't want Robert Mueller in charge of the investigation, Robert Mueller would not have been put in charge of the investigation in May of 2017. I mean, it's May of 2017 was, several months into the Trump administration. They would have had plenty of time to say, no, we don't want this guy. Everybody's trying to treat the situation as if there's some kind of inside knowledge of some kind of wrongdoing by the Republicans who were in charge of the campaign or the people who were in charge of Trump's campaign. So far, they haven't come up with any material evidence. And the president has repeatedly used the internet, used social media, and called this whole thing a witch hunt. What they're exactly trying to witch hunt, you know, would be, you know, it would be amazing if they could pin it to something specific. You know, but that's why the president keeps coming out and he just keeps generally calling it a witch hunt, because he's not going to add any more fuel to the fire. He probably knows exactly who's potentially looking for what, and he also knows how they're, you know, going about things. And the idea that at the end of the day, in a lot of these situations, it is quite plausible that Donald Trump is the only guy in the room that was actually telling the truth or didn't have anything to do with anybody committing anything fraudulent. People have come and gone in his administration for various reasons, and the media attaches a reason for it. They say Russia probe. And it's just bizarre. Very, very bizarre. It goes on. I personally think that we will not see the end of this panel, the closing of this special investigation, until after the midterm elections. I think that it is being played out so that it becomes an issue, so that people who cannot make up their mind or do not being presented with actual facts by the mainstream media will go into the election booths in November. And I think that the media is in a conspiracy. The mainstream media, the four major networks, CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox News, you can add whoever you want to that big player list. I think that they're all in cahoots against this administration. And, you know, and it's really bizarre. Had Hillary Clinton won the election in 2016, and questions would have came up about Russians interfering with the American electoral process, and if none of the information that came out where these 12 indictments have been handed down by the special counsel, would we be looking at any sense of urgency? You know, would a potential Hillary Clinton administration at this point be wanting to shut the investigation down itself? I think in answer to my own question there, I think undoubtedly if we had a Clinton win in the 2016 election, that this investigation committee for Russian meddling may not even exist the way that it does today. I think this is a political machination. I think this entire investigation has taken a political tint. We have a panel of 11 Democrats with no Republicans represented on this panel. And it's just really bizarre. It's, you know, it's something you would not see. Of course, a hypothetical Clinton administration would be jumping up and down about Russians meddling in the election, and they would be saying things in the vein of, oh, well, you see, they tried meddling with the democratic process, but they failed, and so here we are. And it really makes me personally wonder how effective that would be with a Hillary Clinton presidency, where I don't have a single doubt in my mind personally that we would be in a military situation in Syria. I think we would have an end, regardless of a Trump end, to the Iran nuclear deal, because I think that no matter what you saw from Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail and during the Democratic nominating process and everything at the convention, that she potentially, as president of the United States, is more hawkish on war than the news media wants to give her credit for. You know, this is a woman who could not keep facts and figures straight with the Benghazi incident. where we lost our United States ambassador. Our replacement for the President of the United States, the person who answers for the President of the United States in Libya, as well as United States Marines, lost their lives in the incident, and the woman could not be forthcoming and 100% truthful during a congressional investigation and ask direct questions by members of the United States House of Representatives. Were she elected president of the United States in 2016 and assumed office in January of 2017, I don't think that a special investigation into Russian meddling would have the importance that it does during a Trump administration, as it has, and where it has captured the imagination of the American people. It has held the focus in the media, and therefore the focus of the American people, for the last 14 months. And you really have to ask yourself the question, just like a magician with prestidigitation and sleight of hand, watch the left hand so that you don't see what the right hand is doing. And in a hypothetical Clinton administration, they would be wanting you to watch the left hand so you don't see what the right hand is doing, so that they could cover up any additional information that hasn't come out about meddling inside of the Democratic National Committee, inside of the primary system, inside of the push to get rid of Bernie Sanders because he was a threat. He was somebody that they were looking at up until the point that the election was meddled with, that Hillary Clinton may have had to take onto the ticket. Hypothetically speaking, you could be looking at a presidency right now with Hillary Clinton as president of the United States and Bernie Sanders, independent senator from Vermont, elected as vice president of the United States, because it would have went to the Democratic convention. And had Bernie not upset Hillary at the Democratic convention, he would have had to take the second spot on the ticket. Because, I mean, admittedly, Tim Kaine was not even a candidate for president of the United States. And traditionally, the Democratic Party would choose vice presidential nominees from amongst the competing field when it was appropriate. Perfect example, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1960. Rivals for the presidential nomination. Eventually, Johnson accepted the vice presidential spot on the ticket at the convention and through the support of his candidacy in 1960. To John F. Kennedy. You would have seen the same thing in a hypothetical Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders ticket at the Democratic convention had the Democratic National Committee and members of the Democratic Party not conspired against the candidate from their party. Bernie Sanders was seen as an outsider in the 2016 election. There were elements inside the Democratic Party that did not want to see that man upsetting Hillary Clinton. They did not want a repeat of the 2008 primaries, where Hillary Clinton was unable to unseat Barack Obama from a lead in the primaries. And Hillary Clinton was eventually offered Secretary of State in the Obama administration to be able to throw her support and have her people voting for the Joe Biden-Barack Obama presidential ticket in 2008. They didn't want to lose the election to the McCain-Palin ticket and Republicans. And everybody thinks, for some reason, that the 2008 election wasn't as close as it was, because there were, you know, there were issues at the end of the night with John McCain. Well, John McCain is not necessarily seen as, you know, as 100% ideal for people in his own state. It's just reality. You know, John McCain is either seen as too much of a maverick or too conservative for some liberals and too liberal for some conservatives. Now, in a hypothetical Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton administration, I don't think we would be seeing the relevance of this investigation, because there's a possibility that had the Clinton people and the Democratic National Committee people that conspired together to knock Bernie Sanders off, Bernie Sanders might have been on top of that ticket. If Bernie Sanders had taken a second place on that ticket in order to get the Bernie supporters behind Hillary Clinton to make sure that it was more than just a popular vote victory and hypothetically ended up as an Electoral College victory for a Clinton-Sanders ticket. Bernie Sanders' interest would also be in figuring out what was going on with Russian meddling in the campaign, but he would not have a vested interest in unseating the President of the United States as a sitting vice president. So try, I guess, wrapping your head around that a little bit. You know, Bernie Sanders would not be making the statements that he's making about the Trump administration and Vladimir Putin today if he were vice president of the United States, having won the election in 2016. Plain and simple. But the Democrats are going to milk this for all it's worth, as they should, because they don't have a plan. You know, you've got Chuck Schumer. He's up there. He is, you know, the de facto spokesperson, the head guy for the Democrats now in the Senate. I think he's finding out that it's a lot easier to want to be the big guy in the Senate for the Democrats than it is to actually hold down that position, to actually be providing leadership for his party. I think the party's all over the place. I mean, it's just bizarre. Chuck Schumer, red state Democrat, tells Chuck Schumer to kiss my you-know-what on a Supreme Court vote. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, you know, it's just bizarre, okay? And if you're not familiar with them, Senator Joe Manchin is Democratic senator from West Virginia. West Virginia is a red state at the moment. West Virginia, with its history in the coal mining industry, voted heavily for President Trump in the 2016 election. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia had strong words for the Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer, who is a Democrat from New York. Charles Schumer's efforts to unify the Democratic Party against President Trump's Supreme Court pick. Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia suggested to Politico that Schumer does not have any influence over whether or not Manchin supports Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Joe Manchin suggested, "I'll be 71 years old in August. You're going to whip me? Kiss my you-know-what," referred to whipping votes amongst the party caucus, the whipping up of votes amongst the Democratic Party. Senator Schumer has spoken out harshly against the nomination of Kavanaugh and vowed to oppose him with everything I've got. Democrats will need at least 2 Republican votes, in addition to all Democrats, to block the nomination. But Democrats up for re-election in Trump states are not guaranteed votes against the confirmation. And many have signaled that Charles Schumer's efforts may not be enough to convince them to vote against the nominee for the Supreme Court. Senator Joe Donnelly, Democrat of Indiana, told Politico as well, "My decision won't have anything to do with Chuck Schumer." In addition to Joe Manchin and Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat from North Dakota, a senator serving as a Democrat in North Dakota, President Trump has repeatedly made offhanded joking references to Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota that she would be welcome in the Republican Party at any time, indicating, you know, with a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, that the senator would be able to keep her seat in the Senate in North Dakota were she to switch to the Republican Party, and she would have the support of the President of the United States. Joe Donnelly, the Democrat from Indiana, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and Senator Heidi Heitkamp, the Democrat from North Dakota, all voted in support of President Trump's first Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, who also was an aide to outgoing Justice Kennedy from the Supreme Court. Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat from Missouri, told Politico that Schumer knows better than try to pressure her to vote in a certain way. He doesn't come to me and say, you've got to vote on this. He knows I'll tell him to take a flying leap, she said. I'm going to do what I think is right. It has nothing to do with the Democratic Party. I mean, really, so this is, you know, you're not talking about a unified front where the Democrats know they need two votes, two Republicans to flip against the Republican majority to not have the Supreme Court nominee confirmed. After the rules change last year to get Justice Neil Gorsuch passed through approval process in the Senate, the Senate only needs a simple majority of 50 or more votes to confirm a nominee for the Supreme Court. This means if it were a dead 50-50 vote, the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, would be called in as President pro tempore of the Senate of the United States to make the deciding and tie-breaking vote. I could be wrong about this, but I think Mike Pence, Vice President of the United States, has been called upon to do this six times so far in the brief history of the Trump administration on various matters. So I don't see that possibly happening when you have a handful of Democratic senators already saying that they're not going to let minority whip in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, tell them what to do with their vote publicly. You know, this isn't just, somebody saying, well, I heard as an anonymous source that the senator that so-and-so works for said this. You're talking about a situation where the entire Democratic Party would have to be behind keeping the nominee off of the Supreme Court and being able to flip a couple of Republican senators to go along with them to block the nomination. In such a contentious midterm election as we are having so far, I cannot, within reason, see that happening because of the closeness of this and the fact that they only need a 50-50 vote in order to basically bring home the bacon with a confirmation on the Supreme Court. I cannot see any sitting Republican senator not having it within their interest to get their party's president, their party's president, Supreme Court nominee approved when they don't have to go the route of the two-thirds majority. You know, some people are going to say, and rightfully so, those rules need to be changed. The Senate went through the procedures to change those rules in order to be able to do simple majorities because what they said they wanted to expedite getting things done. They said they were tired of going into closed meetings with the President of the United States. They kept asking, why aren't things getting done? I mean, that's really, you know, and it's, well, Mr. President, we need something like a simple majority. Well, then get the simple majority rule put in place and get it done. I don't know that they didn't see this guy coming. I don't think anybody in the Republican Party honestly saw this guy coming. I don't think that there were a lot of people in the Republican Party that were expecting Donald Trump to win the presidency on election night in 2016. And the way that it came out to a handful of double-digit thousands of voters in certain precincts in certain states that flipped the entire vote for those states, which gave now President Donald Trump the electoral majority. And I'm pretty sure if you would have done a straw poll with all the members of the House and the Senate that were sitting at the time, and they were able to be completely honest about what they thought was going to happen, I think that they would pretty much in a majority have said that they would have been expecting to go in having to work with Republican majorities in Congress. but with a Democratic president in Hillary Clinton, and be it Tim Kaine, or in a hypothetical scenario, be it possibly Bernie Sanders. If the election would have been handled by the Democratic National Committee in an honest and forthright manner, which it was not, we have so much proof of that. And I think that's, you know, Bernie Sanders standing up on the soapbox and yelling about the president needs to confront the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, about this election meddling is, you know, it's kind of, you know, I can understand him doing that, but I think personally it would be more important to me standing up and screaming about talk to the president of Russia to make sure this never happens again, because look what happened to me. And I think he's kind of playing his cards a little close to his vest by not standing up and saying, because of what happened to me with the Democrats, with supposedly my party in his case. Look what happened to me with my own party. I got cheated out of a nomination, or I got cheated out of the second spot on the ticket because my own party was going around playing with primary results, rigging things against me. And I don't need to have it complicated by having Russian intelligence agents destroying what my party, the Democratic Party, was doing in the next election. It is quite plausible that Senator Bernie Sanders believes that in a fair situation, in a 2020 primary election season, that he stands a chance of not just being an alternative for Hillary Clinton, where there was a division in the Democratic Party, where there were people that didn't want to vote for Donald Trump. They didn't want to vote Republican. They wanted to vote for somebody Democratic. They wanted to vote for somebody they thought was progressive, and they didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. If Hillary Clinton does not run in 2020, it would surprise me if Hillary Clinton doesn't run again in 2020. And B, it would not be, you know, I couldn't see Bernie Sanders not running. I think that, you know, he may end up second place to somebody in the primary process, whoever manages to come out of the Democratic Party. Now, for the Democratic Party's own good, I think that it's in their best interest to not have Hillary Clinton as a nominee again. I think Hillary Clinton probably shot credibility out the window with the meddling inside their own party against another candidate like Bernie Sanders. And I think that were Hillary Clinton to try to run again in the 2020 election for president of the United States, I think Bernie Sanders would be the first person standing up on the soapbox yelling, calling for Hillary Clinton's head because of what happened where the election was fooled with in order to keep Bernie Sanders from receiving a better share of votes that he did or potentially could have gotten. I mean, it's just my personal opinion. You don't have to count it and say, you know, but hold me to it. And we're here at the top of the hour. It is 5 o'clock Eastern time, 4 o'clock Central, on a beautiful Saturday afternoon. So far, I have not been inundated with any torrential rains. Hopefully that stays the case in beautiful Past Christian, Mississippi, where United Public Radio Network is on the air on the 105 frequency on your FM dial, 107.7 in beautiful New Orleans, Louisiana as well. We will be back after these words from United Public Radio Network. So you want to stay tuned as we go for the station break here at the end of the abbreviated first hour, and we'll see what happens. Stay tuned, folks. You're listening live to United Public Radio Network. This is Voice of the People, hosted by Greg Miller, and we will be right back after these words from Joe in the studio. The empty house was tucked on a cul-de-sac in Henderson, Nevada, a sprawling suburb 20 minutes by car from the all-hours neon hum of the Las Vegas Strip. Five bedrooms topped by a terracotta roof, palm trees waving in the small gravel yard, cool Lilac Avenue address looked as neat and tidy as the other identical properties crammed onto the block, and inside, it was different. In the first week of June, the house was a rollicking mashup of Neverland and a hip-hop video. For days, teens swung in and out, partying in rooms gashed with spray paint. They shot pool and lounged on abandoned furniture draped with plastic sheets. They guzzled vodka, gulped down Xanax, and belched out lungfuls of marijuana smoke. And they gawked for cell phone videos when two teenagers, Jaden Caruso, age 16, and Cody Harlan, age 17, allegedly arrived for the unsupervised bacchanal with two handguns, according to testimony given this past week in a preliminary court hearing. The party was over by the time police pushed through the door on the evening of June 8th with a search warrant. The house was empty. The officers headed for a closed closet door in the first floor hallway. Inside, twisted in a bedsheet and plastic furniture covering, was the body of 17-year-old Matthew Minkler. A single .357 bullet had blasted through the victim's chin. After sealing Minkler within, someone scrawled a message on the closet door. F. Matt. On Monday, testimony was heard at a preliminary hearing for Caruso and Harlan, viewed by the Washington Post on video. Police and witnesses sketched Minkler's final hours and relayed how police eventually came to arrest the two teenagers. But major questions, fogged over by shifting stories and finger-pointing, remained unanswered, mainly whether Minkler's death was the result of Xanax-fueled mistake, a game of Russian roulette gone wrong, or murder. After the hearing, Henderson Justice of the Peace Sam Bateman determined both Caruso and Harlan will be charged as adults in Minkler's death. Attorneys for both defendants did not respond to the media request for comment, but testimony this week highlighted the ugly tension likely to play out as the case marches on. The question of whether Minkler's death was an accident or murder. The victim's mother, Jamie Shanklin, has vocally alleged her son's death was more than a mishap. Miss Shanklin sat in the courtroom throughout the hearing Monday, tearfully clutching a green heart-shaped box. Jaden had a beef with my son. Jaden never told him. He pretended they were friends, Miss Shanklin told the Las Vegas Review-Journal last month. Police might not have learned about it so soon, but for a speeding luxury car. Henderson police officer Catherine Cochran spotted the silver 2006 Mercedes around 7:20 p.m. on June 8th. The windows were down, and inside the officer saw teenagers, she testified this week. The car had no license plate on its front bumper, in violation of Nevada law. When the car failed to properly use its turn signal, Cochran appeared to make a traffic stop, but when she popped on her cruiser's lights, the Mercedes rushed off. The officer pursued the fleeing vehicle, watching as the Mercedes wove into the bike lane and nearly caused a collision. After blowing through a red light, the Mercedes smashed into some landscaping and eventually nosed onto a pole near a Chevron gas station. The nose of the Mercedes, which would turn out to be stolen, the Las Vegas Review-Journal reported, flew open and two teenagers tore off. Officer Cochran bolted for one of the suspects, a young man with shaggy black hair. She cornered him as he was jumping over a nearby fence, pulling his backpack and shoe off before the teenager scrambled over. Officer Cochran quickly tracked him to a nearby business where the employees told her the suspect was hiding in the back. There, holding his remaining shoe in his hands, the officer found Jaden Caruso. Police arrested Harlan a few blocks from the crash scene. A police accident technician testified this week that when the Mercedes was searched, police discovered a black .357 revolver under a plastic bag on the passenger side floorboard. One .357 bullet and a magazine containing four .45 caliber rounds were also inside the car. In the back seat, police found a blue wallet. It was empty, save for an identification card for Matthew Minkler. As Detective Wayne Nichols related in court this week, after Mr. Harlan was taken into custody, he allegedly confessed that the pair had been involved in more than just joyriding a stolen ride. He advised he was present earlier in the evening at a murder, Nichols testified. Cody said that he was present for the shooting, but that he did not shoot the victim. Harlan told police that Caruso had killed Mahler in the abandoned house's kitchen. According to police documents obtained by the Review Journal newspaper, Harlan led police to the body and told investigators that he and Caruso had brought Mahler to the house for a party. Caruso allegedly killed Mahler in Russian roulette, a game where a single bullet is placed in a revolver, the chamber is spun, and the trigger is pulled. Harlan told investigators that Caruso was the only one allegedly handling the gun. Evidence from the body showed Mahler was shot from a distance of at least 2 feet. On Monday, Nichols testified that Harlan confirmed that he had not called 911 to report the incident, and that Harlan did not attempt to render aid on the victim. Rather, everyone fled the house. Later, Harlan and Caruso allegedly returned to the house to clean up the scene, eventually moving Mahler into the closet. Court documents allege the pair also took $300 from Mahler's wallet, later spending the cash on shoes and drugs. Nichols testified that in his first interview with police, Caruso claimed Harlan had been the one who shot the victim. But then police reviewed the videos found on the suspect's cell phones. "He'd been lying to me from the very beginning," Nichols told the court. The video, played in the courtroom on Monday, showed Caruso talking to his camera moments after the shooting. "Bro, I just caught a body," Caruso told the camera, before panning over to Mahler bleeding out on the kitchen floor. Confronted with the video, Caruso told investigators the shooting was an accident and that he was on Xanax at the time, Nichols testified. Further testimony at the hearing this week backed up the allegation that Caruso was the one who killed Mahler. One witness, who had been partying at the house for 2 days, told the court that he was present when the gun went off. "Jaden stood up and he grabbed the gun and then he shot Matthew," the witness told the court. "I didn't realize what had happened until I heard my ears ringing." According to this witness, Harlan was on the couch when Caruso allegedly pulled the trigger. The witness ran after the shot, saying, "I got scared." Caruso's attorney, William Terry, argued Monday that there was no evidence his client or Harlan had planned to kill Mahler. Harlan's attorney, Keith Brower, pressed the point that his client was allegedly on the couch when the bullet was fired. Throughout the testimony this week, Mahler's mother continued to grip the small green box. After the hearing, the first significant step in what would be a long legal drama, Jamie Shanklin told the Review Journal newspaper that the container held her son's ashes. "We're going to bring them every time so he can see his justice being done," she told the newspaper. "This is a good start. I feel like my son Matthew is going to get justice." No, just craziness. Total craziness. The first images of Barbara Coombs and the back garden where she buried her father for 12 years have been released. Barbara Coombs, age 51, had just been gardening in her father's backyard on a street of red brick terrace homes in their suburb near Manchester, England, when she went inside and spotted a box on the dining room table. Sifting through the box, she was repulsed by what she saw, a trove of pornographic photos of children. Among them were explicit photographs of herself as a child, according to a court hearing reported by the Manchester Evening News, England. The images were painful reminders of her childhood, of the decades of abuse at the hands of a father who allegedly used her as a sex slave and raped her hundreds of times, the Guardian newspaper reported, citing the Manchester Crown Court hearing. "I could feel a black cloud appearing over me," Ms. Coombs said in court this week, according to the Evening News. "In a haze of disgust and disbelief, I picked up a shovel I had been gardening with and I walked into the living room where my father was standing." She took the shovel and struck the 87-year-old man, Kenneth Coombs, in the back of the head, according to Greater Manchester Police. As he turned toward her, she hit him again. Then, using the shovel's sharp blade, she cut his throat and watched him bleed to death, according to the evening news. Now, Miss Coombs wrapped her father's body in an old rug and hauled it out to the back garden, hiding it behind a tree, according to police. The next day, she bought about 2,000 pounds of soil, using it to bury the body in a covert grave circled neatly with bricks. The body would remain there for more than a decade. It was a secret Coombs would keep even from her closest relatives, who were made to believe the elderly war veteran had simply died of a heart condition. For 12 years, she lived in the same home, according to police, her bedroom window only yards away from the body of her father. In January, Miss Coombs admitted to killing her father, concealing his death and profiting from his pension benefits. She eventually pleaded guilty to manslaughter, not murder, on the grounds of diminished responsibility. And on Wednesday, a judge in Manchester, England, sentenced Miss Coombs, now 63, to 9 years in prison for manslaughter. The judge, Timothy King, told Miss Coombs he realized that the years of abuse took a devastating toll on her, according to the Times of London. Still, he said, the history of abuse may explain, but not justify, the taking of life. Now, growing up in the Manchester suburb of Stockport, both Coombs and her mother suffered at the hands of Kenneth Coombs, according to the Evening News. He was described in court as a formidable man who served as a mechanic during the Second World War. She had no friends, no life outside the house, where she was treated as a slave and controlled by her father, and she had no one to talk to, attorney Martin Heslop said, according to ITV. Attorney Heslop also said Miss Coombs' father may have even been the father of her first child, who died shortly after birth, according to the Guardian newspaper. When Miss Coombs was younger than 9, her father allegedly took her to a photography club and forced her to expose her genitals as men took pictures of her, according to the Guardian newspaper. Even as Miss Coombs grew older, into her 40s and 50s, her father continued to molest her, she told authorities. When her marriage fell apart, and long after her mother had died of cervical cancer, Miss Coombs and her 16-year-old daughter moved back in with her father. In 2006, Miss Coombs told those close to her that her father had died unexpectedly and that the hospital had handled his cremation, police said. She devised a series of elaborate lies to cover up the killing. She wrote her brother a letter telling him their father had died of a heart attack. She canceled all of her father's medical appointments. She told her daughter that her grandfather would not have wanted the fuss of a funeral. To my knowledge, this man, Kenneth, just disappeared, a neighbor, Terry Seaver, told the Evening News. I was not that friendly to ask where he went. I just did not see him anymore. Over the years, Miss Coombs was profiting from her late father. According to police, she fraudulently received more than £180,000 in benefits, the equivalent today of about $236,000. Then an official from the local housing association reached out to schedule a winter welfare visit for Kenneth Coombs at his home, and the net began to tighten. She decided to turn herself in, according to the BBC. The day before the scheduled meeting, she walked into a police station and confessed to killing her father 12 years earlier. 2 days later, police uncovered his body in the back garden. Prosecutors in court described how Miss Coombs suffered from a lifetime of abuse. Psychiatric reports showed that she suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and severe depression, according to the BBC. Still, Miss Coombs showed absolutely no concern for what she'd done and denied everyone the chance to say goodbye as Kenneth lay buried at the bottom of his own garden, just meters from her own bedroom window, according to Senior Investigating Officer Duncan Thorpe of the Great Manchester Police in a statement. Despite having years to tell someone what really happened, she only came forward when she had no other choice, he added. It was very, very strange. So, I mean, how's that for, you know, someone basically taking it into their, you know, into their own hands to mete out punishment for a situation like that. I mean, it's one thing when we hear about the abuse cases. We had that extreme case of parental neglect. We might say we haven't heard a lot about that with the 13 children in the home out in California. We haven't really had much of an update on the disappearance of the children from the car crash. And it sort of seemed to die away after the car crash out on the number one highway out in California, when the family went over the cliff in the SUV. It's just strange. You know, it just goes away. I mean, it never really does go away. It just ends up in the dustbin under the rug. It's kind of where the Democratic Party is hoping all this stuff ends up from the problems between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And you'll find out that those type of things are just like the lady burying her father in the backyard after a lifetime of sexual abuse in England. That things that you think are buried and gone, they don't stay buried. Politics is kind of like a churn, and the churn keeps going. You know, the churn just rolls right along, and it likes to dig up something that's new, that's fresh. You know, in the past week, there's been an incident with the escort porn star. I prefer to say hooker, involved herself with the president of the United States. And she appeared in the news. Apparently, she was arrested for allegedly violating one of the laws in the state of Ohio, where you are not to touch a patron at an event where there is adult entertainment being put on offer, shall we say. And allegedly, she touched a patron. So then charges were dismissed later on, probably because people didn't want to end up dealing with it. You know, it's if we make something of this, then it's never going to go away because it involves somebody that's, shall we say, newsworthy and politically relevant at the moment. But if something were to happen that involved, oh, I don't know, Jennifer Flowers, former alleged consort of former president of the United States, Bill Clinton, I don't know that it would merit more than 15 seconds or so on the news media in today's day and age. You know, a little over a week ago, a federal judge in California denied a request by the Trump administration to suspend California's so-called sanctuary policies that limit the cooperation between federal immigration authorities and state and local law enforcement. The decision was praised by opponents of the Trump administration's immigration policies. Judge John A. Mendez of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of California ruled that the state's decision not to assist in federal immigration enforcement was not an obstacle. The judge wrote in a 60-page ruling, standing aside does not equate to standing in the way. Judge Mendez described the case as presenting unique and novel questions about the balance in the country between state and federal powers. The court must answer the complicated question of where the United States' enumerated power over immigration ends and the state of California's reserve police power begins, the judge said. He urged Congress to find a long-term solution to federal immigration policy, to set aside the partisan and polarizing politics dominating the current immigration debate, and work in a cooperative and bipartisan fashion towards drafting and passing legislation that addresses this critical political issue. Our nation deserves it, the judge wrote. Our Constitution demands it. Judge Mendez was nominated to the court by President George W. Bush in 2007. Although he denied the federal government's attempt to suspend the state of California's sanctuary policies, he granted the Trump administration an injunction on the more narrow point of a provision in California's labor law that limits an employer's ability to re-verify an employee's eligibility for a job. This specific section of California's labor law appears to stand as an obstacle to the federal government's effort to ensure that employees are legal immigrants. But he left open the possibility that the court could change its ruling on this point when more evidence is presented at a later stage of this litigation. In a statement, a spokesman for the Justice Department, Devin O'Malley, said the ruling on labor law was a major victory for private employers in the state of California who are no longer prevented from cooperating with legitimate enforcement of our nation's immigration laws. But Mr. O'Malley said he was disappointed in the judge's rejection of the injunction on the state's sanctuary laws. The Justice Department, he said, will continue to seek out and fight unjust policies that threaten public safety. Opponents of the Trump administration's immigration policies heralded the ruling as a victory. California is under no obligation to assist Trump tearing families apart, Kevin DeLeon, who's running for senator in November's election, said in a statement. We cannot stop his mean-spirited immigration policies, but we don't have to help him, and we won't. Lawyers for the Trump administration had argued that California lacked the authority to intentionally interfere with local governments' voluntary cooperation with federal immigration officials. California's lawyers responded by saying the state had acted squarely within its constitutional authority and that the sanctuary laws did not undermine the federal government's authority to enforce immigration laws. Trump administration officials have been emphatic that the state's sanctuary policies are violations of the federal immigration law. Soon after filing legal action against California over the sanctuary laws in March, Attorney General Jeff Sessions traveled to Sacramento, the state capital of California, to rail against state officials whom he accused of using every power the legislature has to undermine the duly established immigration laws of America. So there you go. It goes on and on. And it seems like it's a never ending problem, you know? It's just very bizarre. Jeff Sessions in March of 2018 said it's a never ending problem. So what, you know, really, what can you do? The federal judge imposed a possible, you know, penalty this is about the children being returned to their parents, decided not to pursue more in that case. If you're wondering how things are going to go, because we keep talking about how this midterm election and this the effect that it's having on the Trump investigation, the Russia investigation, the California 2018 midterm primary turnout was the highest in two decades. This is on July 13th of 2018. This is yesterday. California's June primary saw the highest percentage of voter turnout in midterm primary elections since 1998. More than 37% of registered voters cast ballots in the primary. That's up more than 12% from the previous midterm primary in 2014. When turnout hit a record low. The June turnout was closer to levels in the 2010 and 2006 primaries, when 33% of registered voters participated. Now, California's Secretary of State, Alex Padilla, certified those results on Friday. While these numbers show great progress, we know that we still have more work to do, Mr. Padilla said. California's high-profile contest for governor and United States Senate likely helped to increase the turnout, said Mindy Ramiro, director of the California Civic Engagement Project at the University of Southern California. California typically ranks in the bottom fourth of states in turnout. You think about that with the large population, with the influence that the state of California has in the Electoral College. California typically ranks in the bottom fourth of states in turnout. The numbers this year are promising, but not high enough to dramatically shift the state's ranking compared to other states, she said. They're good for what we've seen historically, but they're still low numbers. There's this opportunity to build on this good primary and hopefully have a very strong November. Turnout is typically lower in primary elections than general elections. It also is typically lower in midterm years than in years with a presidential election. In Sacramento, in the state of Nevada, in Sacramento County, Nevada County, San Mateo County, Madera County, and Napa County, all registered voters were mailed a ballot in the hopes of boosting turnout. Voters in those counties could mail back their ballots or put them in drop boxes. They could also vote in person at a county vote center. Now, what do you think of that? I mean, what do you think of that? I think that had something to do with it. I think that the increase in voting had everything to do with the fact that all registered voters were mailed a ballot in the hopes of boosting the turnout. It's kind of sketchy about how you could verify that somebody didn't, I don't know, mail back a ballot for somebody that wasn't supposed to be voting or chose differently, but that's conjecture on my part. In the five counties using the new voting model, turnout increased from 2014. All but one county saw an increase from 2010. But the increases were roughly on par with those seen statewide, except in San Mateo, where turnout jumped roughly 17% from 2014. Madera County saw the smallest increase from 2014 at nearly 8%. It was the first time counties used the model for a statewide election. It's too soon to determine whether the new model will boost turnout in the long run. Padilla said the results in the five counties were positive and that he anticipates several more counties will adopt the model in the near future. Among all eligible California voters, including those who aren't registered, about 28% participated in the primary. So there you go. You have 28% of your eligible voting population participating in a primary where you're then going to have an incumbent in some cases, or no incumbent in a lot of cases. So you've got 28% of your voting population splitting itself up by party and whatnot, making the effective decisions for the remaining 71% of the voting eligible population in the state is populated and as large as California. What does this tell you? I mean, when California, it's so large it could have its own economy and be like the ninth largest country in the world. 28% of eligible voters voted midterm primary election. Really? And this was the highest percentage of voter turnout in a midterm primary election since 1998, in 20 years. Really? I mean, really? And the thing about the article, the way this little thing's written, more than 37% of registered voters cast ballots. At the end, they were talking about 28%. See, you can't even get a straight article out of the Associated Press. At the beginning of it, it's 37% and then 28%. 28% eligible voters. But so I'm not going to try to do math live on the air, but you know, if 28% of your eligible and whether they're registered or not, voters voted in the election, but 37% of the registered voters voted. Then what's that tell you? How many people are eligible to vote in the state of California that's that big that haven't even bothered with going to register to vote. Really? If you're not going to vote, don't complain about the situation. You know, look at what you get for government in California. You get insanity. You get Jerry Brown again, and you get Arnold Schwarzenegger when you have, I don't know, Gray Davis and ineptitude running amok. It's just, you know, you couldn't write some of this. The truth is always stranger than fiction. 5 hours ago, 25 people injured after bus overturned on the Los Angeles freeway. Authorities say 25 people have been injured after a bus overturned on a Southern California freeway, but most of the passengers had minor injuries. Los Angeles Fire Department said the bus crashed shortly before 4 in the morning in Pico Union, just south of downtown Los Angeles. Fire officials say there were 32 people aboard the coach bus when it crashed. 4 were seriously injured. Video aired by KABC television showed passengers with bloodied faces stumbling out of the bus. The California Highway Patrol still investigating what caused that crash. So in one sense, 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, I mean, if you're going to be involved in a bus crash, 40 people on a chartered bus, you know, that's probably a good thing. I mean, not that traffic's light in Southern California, north of Los Angeles at 4 o'clock in the morning, but if you're going to have your bus roll over, that might be the time for that to happen. Hopefully, there are no fatalities reported later on, and those people will all be quickly healed of their injuries. Hopefully, they were not life-threatening. California prosecutor has been put on leave after negative comments about Maxine Waters. A prosecutor in Southern California has been placed on leave while his office investigates what officials said on Monday were discriminatory comments he posted on social media that reportedly took aim at Representative Maxine Waters, Michelle Obama, Mexican immigrants, and a person killed in a police shooting. In a Facebook comment, the prosecutor, Deputy District Attorney Michael Sellum, used derogatory terms to describe Ms. Waters, a Democrat who represents a congressional district in Los Angeles, including a vulgar term for part of the female anatomy, and mused that one would think someone would have shot her, according to the San Bernardino Sun newspaper. Now, on Friday, the newspaper reported that the comments and posted screenshots of posts by a person that went by Mr. Salim's name. According to the Sun newspaper, Mr. Salim, a prosecutor with a unit targeting gangs for the San Bernardino County District Attorney's Office, also wrote that a person who had been shot by the police got exactly what he deserved and referred to the person by a derogatory word. In addition, Mr. Selyem posted an altered photo of Mrs. Obama holding a lewd sign. According to the newspaper, it also said that Mr. Selyem published an online post showing a man in an oversized sombrero accompanied by the words Mexican word of the day, hide. By Monday, both Mr. Selyem's Facebook and Instagram accounts appeared to have been deleted. Multiple attempts to reach him by phone and email were not successful. Really? In a statement on Monday, prosecutors in San Bernardino County, which covers a giant swath of inland California that stretches from the Nevada border to the eastern border of Los Angeles County, said they had started an investigation soon after learning about Mr. Sun's negative comments on June 28th. They said Mr. Selyem, age 50, would remain on administrative leave pending the conclusion of the investigation, which they noted could result in disciplinary action leading up to termination. The Sun newspaper reported that Mr. Selyem joined the office 12 years ago. The San Bernardino County District Attorney's Office does not condone hate, discrimination, or the incitement of violence, District Attorney Mike Ramos said at a news conference on Monday. Our community and the entire criminal justice system depends on having fair, ethical, and unbiased prosecutors. We must insist on that. The office said it would have no additional comment, and Christopher Lee, a spokesman for the office, did not immediately respond to an email, phone call, or text message. Ms. Waters has recently been in the spotlight after she urged supporters to push back on members of the Trump administration who are seen in public places and tell them they're not welcome. Mr. Selyem's offensive comment was in response to a Facebook post about Ms. Waters' remarks and a video of her making them, according to the Sun newspaper. Efforts to reach Ms. Waters' office on Monday night were not immediately successful. An assistant district attorney has been assigned to examine cases Mr. Selyem handled in the gang unit, according to the Los Angeles Times newspaper, but Mr. Ramos said there were no immediate indications that Mr. Selyem had exhibited bias, according to the newspaper. So there you go. You know, it really makes me wonder, folks. I mean, I've said it before. You've probably heard me say it on the show. If you're a longtime listener, you know that one of my basic philosophies about this type of stuff is, with social media in particular, you wouldn't post something on your Facebook profile or you wouldn't post it on something like Twitter if you weren't willing to have it published on the front page of the New York Times. Now, some of the text and everything we just went through with this Maxine Waters piece illustrates exactly that, because that's exactly where some of that comes from. You know, and it's just, it's nuts. It's just totally nuts. You wouldn't say something about somebody that, even if they're a neighbor that lives down the street, and you say it on a public forum like Facebook, you might as well have printed it in the New York Times. You know, Maxine Waters, she knows exactly what she's doing. I think she's taking advantage of the way the system is working. And, you know, it's earning her this nickname of Anti-Maxine. Nickname Anti-Maxine Waters goes after Trump and goes viral. Maxine Waters has been in Congress for a quarter century, but in President Trump, her barbed tongue has found a perfect target and an audience. Maxine Waters runs around the U.S. Capitol these days, moving fast in high heels as she balances back-to-back television interviews, speeches, and hearings and hugs from millennials who have called her Anti-Maxine to celebrate her outspoken style. It's an odd new form of celebrity for a 78-year-old Washington fixture who has logged more than 25 years in the House of Representatives, representing Los Angeles from gritty but gentrifying Inglewood to largely white working class Torrance. But in President Trump, her sharp tongue has found its perfect target, and Anti-Maxine has gone viral. Trump was just so outrageous, so disrespectful, such a bully and dangerous for this country. I decided, you know what? I'm taking the gloves off and I'm going to step out, Ms. Waters said. I was going to not only challenge him, but encourage others to see him for what he is, basically a bully, an egotistical maniac, a liar, and someone who did not need to be president. Ms. Waters never seems to tire of pressing this case. She has labeled Mr. Trump a disgusting, poor excuse of a man. She has called Mr. Trump and his associates the Kremlin clan, and began calling for his impeachment soon after he took office. In turn, the president's defenders have labeled her ignorant, an embarrassment, Dirty Waters, and Crazy Maxie. Ken Baum, the chairman of the National Legal and Policy Center, a right-leaning ethics in government group, called her a grandstander. It's odd that you would come out for an impeachment, like right at the gate, he said. This guy takes his hand off the Bible and it's like, impeach him. Through all the tumult, Ms. Waters, once deemed one of the most corrupt members of Congress by a liberal watchdog group, has remade herself from Los Angeles ward politician to a darling of the left. Ms. Waters is still grappling with her newfound celebrity status, which comes with laudatory tweets, online memes, and even a cartoon depicting her as a superhero. She said young people have taught her terms like woke, meaning culturally aware of injustices, and shade, meaning expressing contempt. Her often incendiary rhetoric is not new. Over the years, she has earned the nickname Kerosene Maxine. In 1994, Ms. Waters went to the House floor to repeatedly interrupt a speech by Representative Peter King, Republican of New York, who she felt had been unduly harsh during a hearing into President Bill Clinton's Whitewater controversy. The presiding officer, Representative Carrie Meek, a fellow Democrat, threatened to call the sergeant at arms to formally warn Ms. Waters to desist. She was suspended from the House for the day, a remarkable rebuke from a Democratic House of Representatives. Representative Cedric Richmond, Democrat of Louisiana, who is the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, recalled her outspoken advocacy when Hurricane Katrina devastated his state. He praised her confrontational tone with the president. She is meeting him where he is, and I think that is what people appreciate, he said. Now, Nadine Pearson, age 77, of Riverside, California, came to Washington last week to meet with the congresswoman and attend a rally to protest proposed budget cuts to a federal program helping seniors get affordable housing. I have known of her since 1958 when I came to California to go to college, Ms. Pearson said. She seems just as sincere now as she was way back then. Ms. Waters grew up in St. Louis and was the fifth of 13 children, raised largely by a single mother. She moved to Los Angeles with her children a decade after high school, worked in garment factories and at a telephone company, and enrolled in college at what is now California State University, Los Angeles. She later got into local politics and cemented her activist credentials during a bitter campaign to prevent California pension funds from investing in companies doing business with South Africa during apartheid. Ms. Waters was elected to Congress in 1990 and has easily held her seat ever since, even as the district stretched farther away from inner city South Los Angeles to the mostly white, politically balanced community of Torrance. Throughout her career, she has focused on issues close to her district, including police killings, affordable housing shortages, and financial institutions that bilk their customers. But she has also had problems. She was investigated for 3 years after she contacted the Treasury Department in 2008 to set up a meeting on behalf of top executives from a bank that her husband owned stock in. Though she was cleared of wrongdoing, the inquiry won her the label, one of the most corrupt members of Congress, from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, a liberal group. Ms. Waters, the top Democrat on the House Financial Services Committee, has likened bank executives to gangsters, addressed them as captains of the universe, and threatened to tax their companies out of business. But the securities and investment industry has also been generous, her sixth largest campaign contributor, just after insurance, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. That record made some on the left leery of Ms. Waters, until President Trump's arrival. In January, she refused to attend President Trump's inauguration. "I don't honor him, I don't respect him, and I don't want to be involved with him," she told MSNBC. In March, she said the president doesn't care about the issues facing the African-American community and said that she believed there was collusion between President Trump and Russia to violate the integrity of our elections. Now, progressives regularly walk up to Ms. Waters and tell her that they love her. She's prepared to put her body on the line in order to push back on this nonsense that we're seeing and hearing coming out of this administration, said Tamika Mallory, age 37, an activist. I mean, it's just crazy crazy kerosene Maxine. You know, it's, I mean, what do you think of all that? I mean, what can you say? You know, what can you say? It's just Senator Cory Booker. Okay, and I mean, Senator Cory Booker, likable guy, was also asked about Maxine Waters. And we'll get back to that. You gotta love when you're going through something and you end up instead of just making yourself crazy. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, said Miss Waters comes from a powerful tradition of black women who are unbought and unbossed. Democrats need to be less poll tested, less consultant advised, and they need to speak from their gut and speak from their heart and be fearless, unapologetic and defiant like she is. After the former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly compared Maxine Waters' hair to a James Brown wig, she snapped back, "I'm a strong black woman and I cannot be intimidated." Maya Wiley, the senior vice president for social justice at the New School in New York, said Miss Waters was willing to call out a racially charged attack. "It was a personal attack on her as a black woman," Miss Wiley said. "She stood up to bullying. Miss Waters has come to appreciate her new admirers from the millennial generation. Many of them may have been raised to believe that if they got a good education and did not make waves, life would be easy," she said. "That's not how it always works out." Miss Waters has also faced fierce criticism from people who see her tone as showboating and disrespectful. Over the July 4th weekend, after Miss Waters warned that the Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson testified before her committee, she would take him apart. Kyle Morris, a conservative college journalist, accused her of inciting violence. Miss Waters said she planned to charge ahead. She is also hoping that the new generation discovering her brand of politics will get inspired to enter the fray. "I went to a Drake concert. I've never seen anything like it in my life. I was at the BET Awards with Chance the Rapper, and all these people get up and scream and holler," Miss Waters said. "I keep wondering, where did all these people come from? Why can't they come into politics?" You know, there you go. Perfect, you know, why can't all these people at a Drake concert come into politics? Well, it's because you can only get 27% of eligible voting age voters to register in the state of California and actually go out and vote in the primary. You know, if you can only get 27% of listeners to go to a Drake concert, it wouldn't be a very packed concert hall. I mean, that's really all you can say about that to answer Maxine Waters. Now, she may end up being famous for taking on the president for as long as he's in office, but we'll see, you know, exactly how that comes out. Version of what I was reading from appears in print on July 7th of 2017 on page A13 of the New York edition of the New York Times with the headline, "Anti-Maxine, House Veterans Who've Had It Up to Here with Trump." And you can order reprints of that from the New York Times. It's just relevant to the discussion we had about the midterm elections, and that's about exactly how far back it goes. It goes back a year, symptomatic of the disease, I guess you might say. You've been listening to Voice of the People Radio. I'm your host, Greg Mueller, here on the United Public Radio Network. I'd like to remind you to stay tuned because you don't want to miss Michael Angley, who's coming up next from the beautiful Finger Lakes region of New York. It has been a pleasure coming back onto the air with you. So do stay tuned as live programming continues here on this Saturday afternoon on United Public Radio Network. And remember, please do go visit www.uprmtalkradio.com. Go visit the YouTube channel. And as we have resumed our broadcasting here in the middle of summer of 2018, you'll want to click on subscribe for that YouTube channel so that you don't miss another episode of Voice of the People, Michael Angley, News on the Flip Side, and all the other live programming coming your way here on United Public Radio Network. Thanks for being with us this afternoon, and have a great night, everybody.